Hello, Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Woodbury Podcast. Today, I'm joined by alumnus Tom Darden, who graduated from the Tiger Nation in 1973. Tom is a loyal, generous, provocative, challenging, wonderful alumnus who's also served on our Board of Trustees and on our Investment Committee. He's a terrific guy. It's fun to be able to welcome Tom to the podcast. Tom, thank you for joining us. I'm looking forward to the conversation, so thank you.
Thrilled to be here. No, I look forward to it.
I think it would be great for the audience to learn a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, why you came to Woodbury, you know, what your adolescence was like, what your experience was like at Woodbury. And then after leaving Woodbury, going to, I know, the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, what was that like? What was exciting to you? What was challenging for you? And then beyond college, how have you spent your time? What are you passionate about, Tom?
I was born in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, at the Carlisle Barracks, the Army base there. And my dad had gone to MIT and then was working on the first computer that the military had. He was actually in the Navy, but he was assigned to this computer project, which is at Carlisle. Part of it was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So that's kind of where I grew up as a very young kid. I never assigned much significance to that. You know, it was just sort of part of my life. But I think a lot of that kind of technical, technology-oriented DNA was inside there somewhere. And I grew up very much as a mechanical sort of a kid. My earliest memory in my life is from Carlisle. It was up our backyard of this little bitty house that we lived in next to another small house, kind of in the country. And in the backyard was a rototiller, a little garden, and there was a rototiller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was bigger than I was at the time. I was a little kid. And this thing was completely terrifying and completely fascinating. I was obsessed with this rototiller. I wanted to be near it, but I didn't want to be that near it because I was scared of it. And again, it's interesting how fascinated I was by this complicated mechanical object. You don't assign any significance to that when you're young because, you know, well, it's just the way you are. You assume everybody's that way. But I think, in fact, probably not everybody was that way. My family moved from there to Morganton, North Carolina, where my dad went to work for a furniture company. Then we lived in High Point, North Carolina. Mm. I was in elementary school in High Point, left there in the middle of the sixth grade, moved to Petersburg, Virginia. There moved to Lenore, went to middle school in Lenore. Anyway, it was...
That was thrown a lot. And you came to Woodbury in 1969, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, just think about it. So that was the year after Martin Luther King was killed, I believe, and Bobby Kennedy. Anyway, it was a very tumultuous time. Race relations in the Vietnam War were very much a part of, you know, our everyday lives. It's what we were seeing and thinking about kind of every day. Of course, I was talking about a time when I was in middle school and early high school, but it was extremely influential in me. I was deeply affected by, you know, observing the manifestations of, you know, race relations and America's history, kind of America's original sin, the implications of the history of slavery in America that I was seeing in my little, you know, community around me. And I felt very compelled to try to do something about that. I also came to be quite interested in the environment. Like so many young kids today, I was convinced that we were confronting environmental doom and we better get on it. And a lot of this is population-based. We were terrified about the rapid increase in population, particularly in poor countries, the introduction of more chemicals and plastics and things like that in the environment. A lot of people were very motivated by the environment, and I was to an extreme, including when I was at Woodbury. I can remember being sort of physically sick out of fear and concern about the future of the planet. Hmm. Like, you know, would we survive? I was very obnoxious, carrying on about this to my teachers and fellow students, predicting doom. And I'm really sympathetic to young people today who are so, caught up in that kind of mentality about this thing. Anyway, that was me at the time.
At Woodbury, I remember you telling me that your first year or two was pretty challenging.
I was in sports, very active in sports before coming to Woodbury. And I was very interested in cars. I owned a car before I came to Woodbury.
Wow.
Up in Lenoir. And bought it when I was 13. And I
you drive it?
The engine. I drove it all the time. Drove it all the time. I got not driving my car, but in other people's cars, because I worked on other people's cars as well. It was very much part of this sort of redneck, I say that affectionately, redneck mechanic hot rod community, kind of helping the older guys. Got thrown in jail twice.
Wow.
In Lenoir because of activities associated with cars. I was in the back seat both times, I will say. But anyway, we were just out kind of causing trouble and carrying on. So, I came to Woodbury. I was interested in sports, interested in cars, and I was definitely not interested in academics. And I failed two courses my first trimester. And I know that I was one of five students discussed by the faculty at the summer or, spring board meeting.
Yeah.
Right. To be not invited back. I mean, whether to be invited back or not. Two or three were, not invited back. Two or three were invited back. I'm sure that Coach Card had something to do with me being invited back because I was a pretty serious football player. I don't know that that's true. In any event, I was invited back, but I was approximately last in my class.
Wow.
The first year. Decided in there somewhere. I just thought I was going to get into college on football or basketball or, sports. As I was not growing anymore, I didn't realize that, but it dawned on me kind of in my fourth form here that I wasn't going to grow anymore. And I walked in the door at Woodbury at 6'2", 185 pounds. And a year later, I was 6'2", I weighed 185. So thought I need another plan. Decided to start studying. And I was about halfway in the class. My fourth form year, I know I was number 10 last fifth form year. And there were a bunch of shocked boys in my class thinking, who is that idiot? Because they knew I was an idiot. And I think they were right. But somehow I was kind of ranked among them. And then I wrote one first in the class, first trimester, sixth form year, which was just ridiculous, particularly ridiculous. So Richard Thompson, clearly the smartest guy in our class, clearly a lot smarter than me. It was the only trimester he was not number one of the 12 trimesters that he was at Woodbury. He beat me back in the second two semesters that year I graduated too. But anyway, I just got really, really serious about academics when I was at Woodbury, and I loved it. I came to be just obsessed with Spanish and French and history and English, and just really loved it.
Obviously, you wanted it to do well. You're motivated to do well. How do you think you flipped a switch so authoritatively about just the love of learning? Were you always a curious kid?
I was, but what I was curious about was cars or lawnmowers or bicycles or, mechanical objects. And they just had this obsession with kind of mechanical, technical things. I was always trying to get into a garage or somebody's shop or help somebody working on their cars. I also worked all the time when I was young. I mowed lawns. I just started working when I was 10 or 11. We were free range kids for sure, living in small towns. And I made money, was motivated by that. Just ended up loving to work. And at Woodbury, I manifested early on a lot of that work in sports. I also worked on cars. This is when the automotive shop was built, by the way.
Right.
By the Finch family, they paid for it. God bless. But so I was either in the shop or I was playing sports. And once I realized how they were my future would unfold, I decided to start studying. And so it was easy for me to work hard. And I feel like with academics, if anybody gets really serious about a subject, like the more you bore into it, kind of the harder you work, the more you bore into it, the more detailed. Almost like the narrower it gets, the more interesting it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true for me as well.
As a Woodbury student, what was you loved sports. What was the opportunity to engage in sports like at Woodbury for you, the interscholastic part of it where you got to compete?
Yeah, I was on the Bengal football team when I first showed up, and the next year played on the varsity and lettered that year. So I had a pretty good year as a sophomore. I actually didn't really like the culture of football very much. And I don't know, a lot of this was a mental thing as well. It was just related to some of the kind of the tough times in society at that point. And I didn't play my junior year. Interestingly, yeah, which was upsetting, I think, to, you know, teammates and coaches and whatnot. But I was just, you know, kind of obnoxious, or anyway, just wasn't going to do it. And I then played my senior year and had a great year. Was all Central Virginia that year. Basketball, every year I got shorter and shorter. Who are these guys? So anyway, I played on the varsity. 3 years. That was fine. A lot of fun. And then I was captain of the lacrosse team, co-captain of the lacrosse team, Chip Godin, MVP, and, you know, played lacrosse at Carolina. I was a goalie. So anyway, I had a great sports career. Very fortunate. And, yeah, I think sports affects your brain. I really think sports affects your brain. Being in positions of enormous stress, you know, for short periods of time, I think is good for you. Stress, fear, you know, all that stuff. It's good. I think losing is good. Winning is good. And it's good all the way around.
So. Yeah. Competing is good.
Yeah. Competing is good. It's good whether you win or you lose.
Yeah. To be in the arena, it's good.
Exactly. Exactly. It translates into so many other areas of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think football, by the way, in many ways, more than any other, you know, it's not my favorite sport, might have been my best, but I think football, the ratio of work to reward is a very high ratio of work to reward. You know, you play one game a week. You don't, yeah, you know, those sports, you play two games a week, just as an example. And practice is so tough. And by the way, you only play half the game, you know, because right, you're on defense or offense. You know, you're not playing the whole game like you are right in a sport. I don't know. I think football really does build character. I'm a huge fan of football. I'm a huge supporter of football as a sport.
Yeah.
Standing my mental problems junior year, let's say.
Yeah.
And it got me in college, by the way. I got in, was offered spots on the football team at Harvard and Yale coming out of Woodbury. And I'm sure that, I mean, it just happened. The coach called and talked to the coaches there. That's where I wanted to go to college. One of those schools called up today. We got kids. This information.
Why'd you end up at Carolina?
Because I took the money. So to my shock, I was nominated for the Morehead and went down and I got it. I had not applied to Carolina at the
time. Wow.
Pretty interesting. I wanted not to go to Carolina. I didn't. I affirmatively wanted not to go to Carolina, having grown up in North Carolina. Uh-huh. Got offered the money. And my dad was in law school when I was at Woodbury. It's pretty interesting.
I was in law school when you were at Woodbury.
Yeah, he quit work and went to law school. So he was in law school. And, you know, not that that was, I mean, and my family didn't have a lot of money. My mom was a school teacher and my dad ended up being a small town lawyer. They were fine, but I was on scholarship at Woodbury. Let's put it that way. You know, I would have been fine. If I'd gone to one of those schools, I would have gotten loans, scholarships, et cetera, and worked and paid for it. But meanwhile, you know, it's a full ride plus an allowance. By the way, I worked the whole time I was at Carolina. So, you know, I was saving money.
Yeah, you left school, you left college with money.
Oh, a lot of money, actually. Yeah. I was a saver my whole life and I was always making money. And I left Carolina UNC with a lot of money.
I believe you were in the first class that was integrated.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, I actually forgot that, but no, I'm sure that that's true. You know, it was, I would say, much less of an event to us than it really was. Like, I mean, we were just, you know, you're a 13, 14, whatever year old boy. You just kind of take the circumstances of your existence as they are. You know, it's like, this is life. it was not a event. Like nobody, there was one person there, one person that I know at Woodbury in any grade who kind of made us think about it. And we were on his back. I mean, we were, this guy got very little slack. You know, he would make a snide comment or some obnoxious comment. And we would not put up with it. I'm not saying just me. I mean, the whole school reacted very negatively to anybody expressing any kind of negative racial, you know, sentiments. I think Woodbury, you need to talk to, you need to talk to the black kids, not talk to me, you know, an oblivious white guy. I don't know. I felt like people were very open and accepting, kind of tolerant. By the way, I went there the year before I went there. I chose a kid in my eighth grade class at Lenoir Junior High School. And I said to him, he was a great guy. I said, look, this school's never had a black president in student body. Next year, I wasn't going to be there. I was going to be at Woodbury. Ninth grade. And I said, I want you to run. I want to manage your campaign. I'm an athlete. I'll get all the athletes to support you. I'll go beat up the, you know, the other white kids. And 15% of the population probably was black. This is in the mountains of North Carolina. So not a lot of black kids. So they'll support you. And you're going to win this election. And I gave speeches on his behalf to the student body. I mean, and he won. I later went to Carolina. We reconnected.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
But I've always had this thing about race. It's always been a deep issue for me. So anyway, I'm thrilled Woodbury did that. Obviously, should have happened sooner. But
Tom, we once had a conversation where you were telling me about a couple of times you hitchhiked a pretty far distance. Tell us about that.
I was, when my parents moved to Chapel Hill from Lenoir, which around the time of my ninth grade, I mean, after I finished eighth grade in Lenoir, went to Woodbury, around that time, my parents moved to Chapel Hill. I say my parents moved, and I didn't move. I moved to Woodbury. And anybody say, where do you live? I say, I live in Woodbury Forest, 22989. And my parents live over there in Chapel Hill. But I didn't want to be there, and my friends were in Lenoir, and I thought, well, I'll go see my friends. And so I guess it started the summer before I came to Woodbury. I went out the road and hitchhiked up to Lenoir, 3 hours away. And my parents knew I was going. I mean, I told them, and they weren't excited about it, but it's kind of the way the world was. And it was great. And so I could get there spent a night with a friend up there and hung out with the people that came back. And at that point, a light bulb went off, which is, I can go anywhere I want. And so not long after that, I went to Myrtle Beach because some of the girls from our class, Lenoir, were down there. So I went down to see them. Got arrested down there, by the way, charged with vagrancy for sleeping under some bushes. I hitchhiked up to Virginia, hitchhiked to Woodbury a number of times, to and from Woodbury, incidentally. It was a different time. And then I hitchhiked to Louisiana. I hitchhiked to Norfolk one time, then up to New York from Norfolk. You know, I would go all these long trips, always alone. Hitchhiked to Montreal, hitchhiked to Texas, went to Los Angeles, hitchhiked up to San Francisco. I hitchhiked all over America. And then my first year at Carolina, after my first year at Carolina, I went over to Europe. And hitchhiked all over Europe. I later added it up. It'd been 24,000 miles that I'd hitchhiked between the ages of 13 or 14 and 19. I never really hitchhiked much after that. But, it was fascinating. It was freedom. I could go where I wanted to go. Always slept outside, sleep on a piece of plastic and with a sleeping bag. And it was great.
Did you ever get scared?
Yeah, I got scared when drunk drivers would pick me up, which is not often, but every once in a while you get in a car and somebody's drunk. So that's a bit of a problem. One time I got in a car with somebody drunk and had a gun. It was not uncommon to be in a car with somebody had a gun. Not that they were pointing at me, but this guy was pointing at it pretty much. He was literally had this guy kind of waving around and driving this car. So, anyway, I got to be pretty good at talking to people into letting me drive. So, hey, well, you want to let me drive this car? So you were arrested for drunk driving and shooting. And then I said,
you look tired. I'll help you.
Yeah, exactly. So Well, hitchhiking was an important part of my life, by the way. And I think it got it, you know, I'm a very introverted kind of a guy, but it forced me to talk. It forced me to communicate with strangers. And it was great. I became kind of an anthropologist. Like, I was always curious, like, where's this person from? And where's this person kind of coming from as a person? And, you know, what can I learn from this? I'm working all right. I'm not saying that it'll ever happen, but anyway.
I know you've had a long-standing passion for the environment. How has that shaped your life after, you know, Woodbury and Carolina?
I mean, I went to law school. Well, from Carolina, I got a scholarship or fellowship, you know, program called a Lutz Scholarship to go to Asia. And I worked for the Korea Institute of Science and Technology for an environmental research group over there. So that's kind of my first job after college. I also went my fourth year at Carolina, finished early in Carolina. My fourth year there, I went to grad school and got a master's degree in urban planning, in environmental planning. So sewage treatment, waste treatment, et cetera. Then I worked doing that over in Korea. I had applied to law school. I wanted to be an environmental lawyer. That was my goal. I wanted to work for EPA. Literally, I was at Woodbury. I wanted to work for EPA, work for the government on environmental issues. I went to law school to be an environmental lawyer. When I was there, it just kind of was driven crazy by the academic. I sort of came to be frustrated by the intellectualism of it compared to a more tangible kind of work, if you will. And I just thought, do I really want to be sitting in a quiet office, you know, for my whole life? And I ended up being the only one in my class at Yale, 165 people, who never went to work for a law firm. Kind of thought straight away, I began interviewing with anybody that came on campus. It's not a law firm, including government agencies and companies. And I got a job at Bain & Company in Boston. So I went up there, worked at building computer programs, programming computers, mainframe type computers, statistical analysis of energy conservation, energy efficiency in heavy industry, particularly the steel industry. And I love being in the plants, gathering the data from the plants, and then doing this statistical analysis. So then I knew how to do that. And I thought, well, let me do that in other industrial settings, and ended up buying brick manufacturing companies, four of them initially, and then eventually four more, a total of eight, that used a lot of natural gas and fuel oil, and converting them to using biomass as a source of energy, which obviously has much better environmental impact, CO2, et cetera. And I also started with some professors at Virginia Tech, a company to grow bacteria for cleaning up pollution in the ground. So bioremediation, the use of biological processes to consume carbonaceous material, in that case, petroleum, and began a company selling bacteria, called Cherokee Biotechnology, selling bacteria. And then we started a company to clean up the contaminated soil. And that turned into a real estate business. So this is buying contaminated land and cleaning up contaminated land and selling the contaminated land. So that's been a big part of my life. And then I've stayed in the environmental technology invention or development world. I started a company to make power meters, electric power meters that you could turn on and off based on input from solar or wind or different types of energy. And I've got maybe 20 or 25 patents associated with power grid management. Just started recently a company making EV chargers that use some of that kind of technology for things. You can control them, like when they would turn on, when they would turn off, and encryption systems for those to kind of protect the power grid. And then Fusion Energy, started a fusion company that's...
We'll get to the fusion in a second, but I want to... Just ask, in your lifetime, have you struggled with the feeling like, you know, you were saying earlier about the environment that you were just worried that it was doomsday, and now, you know, you're working so, you know, just enmeshed in this world of the environment. How did you manage like the emotional ups and downs of being in that world? And dealing with conflicting emotions of hopefulness and excitement, and then just also dealing with you know, maybe even moments of despair about the environment.
I think, you know, one issue is you need to learn to accept the things that you really can't control. And,
yeah,
you know, the serenity prayer, or, you know, how to tell the difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, that certainly factors into it to some degree. Really, more than that, you know, human beings have done fine, like put quotes around fine, but have done okay, have survived on Earth for millennia under incredibly varying types of conditions. And yeah, sure, if Greenland, you know, if we melt all the ice on Greenland and the ocean rise by 200 feet or whatever it would be, that would be a bad day. Don't get me wrong. I don't know. I think the odds of that happening are relatively slim. You know, you can always predict some kind of runaway event. You know, we're going to get to a tipping point and then, you know, something bad's going to happen. I suspect that's probably not going to happen. There are checks and balances in the biological chemistry, physics, you know, system of the Earth, where as things warm up, there's a counterbalancing, you know, natural response to that, blooming of bacteria, prospering of carbon growth in regions that support that, in trees, et cetera. It's not a likely thing to occur. This is in no way to say, I'm not saying that the Earth is not warming. Saying the Earth is clearly warming, you'd have to be an idiot to think that it's not. This is measured, but at the same time, so there will be, and if you live in a hot place, it's going to be hotter, no question. If you live in a cold place, it's going to be a little warmer. I don't know. I think people are going to adapt. I think we need to focus on adaptation. I'm probably more concerned, frankly, about chemistry related, chemicals. Mm-hmm. And sort of, you know, chemicals that affect our biology.
Right.
And, you know, some of that stuff is very pernicious, very little known, very little tested. I worry about that relative to mm-hmm. my grandchildren, to, you know, future generations. Some of these strange effects that we're seeing, you know, reduced testosterone levels.
Yeah, right.
It's a lot of things like that.
Yep.
That's a bigger deal to me than the climate change stuff. I also think, by the way, climate change has become kind of a religion. It also has been a grifter opportunity. A lot of people are making a lot of money on climate change one way or another, you know, through consulting or through, you know, politics or through selling things that probably won't make much difference. I think if you did a financial analysis for the world of all the money that's been spent on climate change, how much of it actually made any difference as opposed to investments that were more energy efficient and that were rational, sensible investments, well, those would have happened anyway. But how much money has the government or governments around the world dumped on this problem, and how much of it actually reduced CO2? I'm pretty skeptical about that. Also, we're only 15% of the CO2 now in America. We were 50% when people started worrying about this stuff. And so really, this is a conversation that needs to bring in Russia, India, China, and Africa, the continent of Africa. And I'm just telling you, I've been to these COP conferences. You know, I'm all the Board of Environmental Defense. I'm just telling you, those countries that I just named, countries and continent that I just named, are pretty uninterested in making any changes to what they're doing for the benefit of the climate. So if let's say 60 or 70% of the carbon emissions are not in the room. I mean, they may be in the room, but they're not participating. Then what are you going to do about it? So we need to learn to adapt.
Yeah. And your interest in this fusion project, maybe your attempt to do that. Tell us a little bit about that. It's fascinating.
Yeah. So I was approached by some people about fusion after never really having seen any startups working on it. This is a long time ago, and having been around environmental technology investing always, but I'd never really been approached by a fusion startup. And I got three sort of knocks on the door within 30 days of each other, you know, one, and 30 days later, another, 30 days later, another. And I saw, what is going on? I need to listen to this. And I began investigating alternative methods for creating fusion. You create fusion the way it is in the sun with massive temperature and pressure, but that's hard to do on Earth. It will happen someday, I think. Alternatively, there are other strange forms of fusion that occur, and they're easier to do, but harder to understand. And I thought, well, what if we explore that? And so I set up a company to do that, and ultimately raised about $120 million total. I began spending money on it myself, and then other people were joining in, raised serious money. And we have labs all over the place working on, we've built certainly more than 1,000 small nuclear reactors that we test to see if we can cause this reaction to occur with varying degrees of success. And I'm in a lab right now, by the way, as we speak, I'm in a lab at NC State. We have a lab in Switzerland, a lab in Australia, a couple of labs in New Mexico, but one in Austin, Texas. We had others previously that are all working on this. And I don't know, fusion would be an ideal form of energy. There are reasons to pursue this. This actually would make a difference. That's not the simple fact that it would make a difference doesn't mean that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I remain semi-optimistic, but it's worth doing, even if you fail. So it's a quest, it's a mission, and it's important. So I'm motivated by it.
What exactly would the difference be?
Well, you're using non-radioactive fuel. You're using the most plentiful substance in the universe, hydrogen, as the fuel. You would have the reaction itself would emit radiation, but you would have little or no radioactive byproduct. So the problem with nuclear power, fission nuclear power, the current nuclear power using uranium, heavy elements, is that the fuel is radioactive and the waste is radioactive. And so in this case, you could have non-radioactive fuel and, to a large extent, 99% true, not radioactive waste. So hugely better in that sense. In our case, we have a very small form factor. These are real small devices, so it wouldn't have to be so big and centralized.
Right.
Anyway, it would just be a lot of benefits. And theoretically, it would be cheap. But for it to be cheap, it has to work first. So what the heck?
So you're spending a lot of time in the lab. What's a day? What's a normal day look like for you right now?
Well, I show up in the lab in the morning, and there are 25 things I have to deal with that don't relate to this. Okay, I'm also in the real estate business and have other technology venture stuff, and I'm involved. I'm on the board of Shaw University, the oldest HBCU in the South, and on the board for 35 years before an environmental defense fund. As I mentioned before, and several corporate boards. So, I have a lot of outside things that are kind of tugging on me. So a lot of my day is not scheduled by me. We do have a research program going in our different labs, and so I'm very involved in that, in setting the direction that we're going. What are we going to be testing? What are we going to test? How are we doing the statistical analysis of the tests that we're doing? What's the data looking like? Where we're failing, which direction should we shift from that? And then the encryption system, I didn't invent that, but I'm kind of leading the effort to activate that. The encryption system was designed as a part of the fusion system. It's really complicated, but it was. And so then we pulled it out to use as a separate product. So it's encryption against quantum computers. It would defeat quantum computers, attacks on quantum computers, which are going to be necessary increasingly. So yeah, I spent time on that. The EV chargers, we manufacture them right here. It's in the two doors down in this same lab. We build EV chargers here. I'm hoping we can build a lot more of those.
That's great. Yep.
Anyway. And then I spend time with my kids and grandkids whenever I get a chance. And that's pretty much all I do is work. I love my work. It's my hobby also. And I hang out with my family. And I think if you're really serious about your work, then you really don't have much time for anything other than sort of work. And I define the nonprofit type stuff, and religious stuff that I'm involved with. I define that as being part of my work. It's this work project. And then family. And I'm a lucky guy to have a working family. Until my time, I'm almost 70 years old with that.
That's fantastic. One final question. You predated me not only as a student, but also your experience on the Woodbury Board of Trustees. So when I got to Woodbury as headmaster, you had already rotated off the board. What was your experience like as a Woodbury board member?
It was fabulous. What an incredible bunch of people you have on that board. And I think for decades, you've just had really wonderful people on that board, a few of us as exceptions. But I'm so inspired by the others who were involved. Service to Woodbury, Woodbury obviously meant a lot to me. I was on scholarship at Woodbury. I'll say that probably three or four times before this is over. I was on scholarship at Woodbury. That's very meaningful. So being able to engage and give back in some little way from a leadership standpoint. I was very involved in building stuff. I've always been involved in construction and real estate. And so I was on the Building and Grounds Committee and ended up chairing the Building and Grounds Committee. And that was a wonderful experience. I was on the Building and Grounds Committee when we cut down the two big trees that are over here, the residence.
Yeah.
The most important thing I was involved in, not just kidding, but all kinds of building projects happened. Probably the most controversial were cutting down these trees.
Trees, yeah.
They were going to fall on the residence, guys. We had to cut them down. it was great.
Well, you're a great alumnus and a real testament to Woodbury Forest at the best of who we at least aspire to be, Tom. So I'm really appreciate you being on the podcast and always enjoy our time together and I'm grateful that you would share a portion of your fascinating life story with us on the Woodbury podcast. So Tom, thanks for joining us and go Tigers, everyone, and happy Thanksgiving.
Go Tigers.
Thanks, Bart.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!